From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour is made in Rochester, on our streets, in our towns, and it doesn't just happen in the winter. I will be honest, most of the conversations about homelessness on this program have happened, at least under my heading of this program, during the coldest months. Maybe that's understandable to a degree, but it ignores the fact that homelessness is an issue year-round. And next month, a symposium seeks to address many issues related to homelessness, including the idea that housing is a human right. That is the theme of the Homeless Services Network of Rochester's 14th symposium, and they're going to focus on housing as a human right, what housing first means. It's coming up Wednesday, September 27th, and we'll make sure you've got more information as we go throughout the hour here. But my guests are here to help us understand the issues not only brought up at the symposium, but also address the issues relating to homelessness in our community. And let me go ahead and say hello to the faces around the table, starting with Reverend Peter Peters. He's a retired Episcopal priest and a founding member of REACH. And Reverend Peters, what is REACH for those who don't know?
REACH stands for Rochester Emergency Action Committee for the Homeless. It was founded 3 winters ago, and we've run shelters for the chronically homeless for the past 2 winters.
It's great to have you. Thank you for taking the time to be here. Also here is Connie Sanderson, Executive Director of the Rochester-Monroe County Homeless Continuum of Care. That's the COC, if you hear it described that way. Connie, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Nick Coulter is co-founder of Person-Centered Housing Options. That's PCHO, what's the short version of what that is, Nick?
We're an innovative nonprofit program that seeks to end chronic homelessness using the Housing First model here in Monroe County.
Okay, and also here is Alan Gordon. He's a senior case manager for the VOA. Alan, welcome to the program. Thanks for taking the time. Reverend Peters grabbed me at a recent conference we were both at, and we got to talking about what's coming up at the symposium. And we talked about housing as a human right, which I know that you're working on specifically for this symposium. So let's start with what Housing First is. And I think all our guests around the table can offer perspective on what that means, because you're going to hear that this hour. What is Housing First, Reverend?
Well, I want to say, first of all, I acknowledge that I learned about Housing First from Nick Coulter and also from Andy Carey, two social workers who worked with us at REACH's first emergency shelter on Prince Street. And I watched the social workers house many of our guests. I saw the change in the attitude of our guests who felt secure once they were finding places of their own to live. And they were able then to deal with some of their issues in a much more helpful and supportive way. So I became a disciple of Housing First as a result of meeting Nick and Andy. And REACH has accepted that as being a primary way of addressing the problem of homeless people in our city. We do not want to see another Sanctuary Village. We do not want to see another tent city. We want to work hard to see how we can provide the kind of affordable and accessible housing that will house all people regardless of their challenges in life.
I'm going to ask Nick for his definition in just a moment, but let me follow up and just ask you, when you say we don't want to see another tent city, we don't want to see another sanctuary city, why do you put it in those terms?
I came to Rochester. I'm an Australian, and I've been through the winters in Rochester, and it's quite grueling, and I do not think any human being should be left out in the cold in Rochester.
So that's
winters.
What you mean by that, yeah.
Yeah, and let me speak as a person of faith. I'm writing the paper on housing as a human right for the symposium. Most of our religious traditions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, all speak about hospitality for the stranger. And it seems to me that part of what we need to do is hold the public bodies that administer housing rights to that kind of understanding. No human being should be without shelter.
All right, let's turn to Nick then. The definition you give for Housing First, Nick.
Yeah, Housing First has really basic 5 principles that we need to follow in order for it to be Housing First. First off, immediate access to housing without preconditions. Individuals and families need to be able to move into housing as soon as you're able to provide that to them. Consumer choice, so the person needs to be able to choose where they live, choose what services they select, and be able to tailor that to their needs. We take a recovery recovery orientation, so we're always focused on recovery and self-sufficiency and working with folks to be more independent. Individualized person-driven supports, so the person is driving the bus or driving the car and we're guiding them through the challenges. And then basic community integration and social inclusion. We want to create a community within the places because a lot of the folks have been displaced for so long from housing that they don't know what it feels like to have a neighbor or to have a friend or to have a support system. So Housing First is really simple. We put people in housing first, and then we provide a robust network of services to support their needs. And that's it.
We're going to talk with Nick as we go throughout the hour about the experiences that he's had that show whether that approach can work. And I know, of course, you do believe it does.
Oh, yeah.
So we'll ask for some of those examples. I know that Alan Gordon, as the senior case manager for the VOA, has a view of Housing First and this kind of model in kind of a different sense there?
It's more of a centralized version because we operate our programs all on one site. And we own one of those sites, the building, so we do not have to deal with the landlord. We are the landlord. And that makes a large difference, and I will echo what the Reverend said, because it was very well said that everyone deserves housing. Everyone deserves some shelter. And the lowest barrier we can provide is going to allow our community to react, which is a lot of times people don't realize that are out in our community how difficult it is to just get shelter when you're not making a certain amount of money or you're not working 2.5 jobs, and it becomes very taxing. And I have people who come in every day that they've been beaten down by the system. Very hard to get through that. So I don't want to put any more weight on them. I want to get them into a shelter as quickly as I can.
Okay. And I want to turn to Connie for a little bit of background on some of the numbers, because before the program began, there was a brief conversation in the studio about how the average person, and if you're listening to this program right now, if I ask you to think about what homelessness means, what's the image that comes to your mind? And I don't ask you that as a way to be, you know, snarky or looking down on anybody. I mean, a lot of us probably have a similar image, but Connie, I think, has some important context to what that means.
I think that Rochester, Monroe County, we've fairly managed the homelessness issue in this community fairly well. When you look at Rochester compared to, say, cities on the West Coast where there's obvious unsheltered homeless people living permanently in encampments and tents. So though we've managed it fairly well in terms of keeping the numbers fairly steady, we really now need to go that next step and make sure that people are permanently housed. I think that people would be shocked to learn that, more than 7,000 people in this community experience homelessness for at least one day. And that was in 2016. These numbers, again, have stayed fairly steady over the past couple of years. We do an annual point in time count every year during the last week of January. And that number for 2017, January 25th, was 817 people.
In the city of Rochester alone, or Monroe County?
In Monroe County.
Monroe County, 817 at the end of January, okay.
So of the 7,000 people that I spoke of over an annual basis, probably actually more than half, about 4,500 of those are people and families, so adults and children. And that's often something that people don't think about when they think about the homeless population. We, again, have been very blessed that households with children very rarely see unsheltered families in this community. And again, that's because we've been able to develop enough shelter beds for the most part for families. And we just want to make sure that we continue in being successful in at least providing shelter and then getting them into permanent housing as quickly as possible.
Okay.
Last thing I would just say is the ultimate end of homelessness is an adequate supply of affordable housing for a community as a total, not just for homeless populations, but for low-income households, so that people aren't going through cycles of homelessness because they've been evicted because they can't afford a place to live.
Okay. Now, the symposium that we mentioned off the top of the program is coming up in about a month. It's Wednesday, September 27th, from 8:30 to 4 out at RIT. And Reverend Peters, who is sort of the target audience? Who do you want to attend?
We would like to see anybody connected with the homeless community, but in particular, workers with the various agencies. But we'd also like to see landlords come. We'd like to see landlords come and learn something about the challenges of making homes available to the homeless population. So we'd like them to come. We'd like to see bankers come because they finance a lot of the buildings that we're concerned about. So we'd like to see a big investment on the part of the Rochester community to address what we think is a significant social issue for our community and region.
And if you want to sign up, how do you do that, Reverend?
The best way to do that right now is to send me an email address, and I'll send you a registration package. And my email address is peterwpeters@me.com.
peterwpeters@me.com. Again, it's Wednesday, September 27th, coming up here. Housing is a human right. The Housing First Symposium, 8:30 to 4, out at RIT. I want to explore one more question before we really kind of dive into some of the particulars. You mentioned from your spiritual background, your view of housing as a human right, how often it's invoked in Scripture, for example. How often is it invoked in across faith traditions?
Well, let me tell you a couple of interesting things about that. I'm going to give away part of my paper.
Well, that's good. That's what you're here for.
I just been finishing looking at the Jewish tradition. And some interesting things about the Jewish tradition is the constant emphasis on welcoming the stranger into a tent or into a building. So, for example, the early stories of Abraham talk about him welcoming three strangers and welcoming them into his tent. The wonderful festival of Sukkot, where Jewish people leave their nice homes and live in a straw-built cover to remind themselves of their wandering period. They are expected to welcome guests into their sukkah, the shelter that they create. So there is all of this emphasis on welcoming the stranger, reminding us that none of us are anything more than guests on this planet, and that every guest deserves to be in shelter. So that's for the Jewish tradition. I'm working right now on the Christian aspect, but my main theme there is Jesus never turned anybody away from the table. Everybody was welcomed to the table. Jesus himself seems to have been homeless. He stayed in all sorts of people's homes. I don't know of any permanent residence other in his early years. So he was a person who welcomed anybody. So from my point of view as a person of faith, it seems to me I have to get to the place in my own heart when someone who I meet who happens to be homeless is my brother, my sister. And what can I do to enable that person to be safe? Homelessness is about welcoming the stranger, regardless of who they are and what they might have been through in life. So that's my faith roots for doing this.
But Reverend Peter, some of the biggest followings that religious leaders have in this country are people like Joel Osteen, who talks a lot about how Jesus wants you to drive an even better car, and God would like for you to be rich, and you deserve it.
That's not the Jesus that I've met. The Jesus that I've met is the one who spoke highly of the widow who gave her last mite into the temple purse. The Jesus that I've met who told the rich young ruler, you got to give it away and learn to live justly with other people.
So why are we so often not following in that model of the Jesus that you know?
If I knew the answer to that, I would be in a different job.
Fair enough. Let me go across the table and ask Nick Coulter. When we think about housing as a human right, you went over some of the tenets of what Housing First means, but housing as a human right, you know, this is where the issue that for our listeners, and I would encourage our listeners, call the program. We'd love to hear from you. 844-295-TALK. It's toll free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Do we need to start talking about housing more, not just as a convenience or something that you know, that the wealthy can afford, but as a human right? And you know, are you ready for some of the pushback that people have who are uncomfortable with saying, hey, look, I want to help people who are homeless, but as a human right, you know, what do you say to those who push back a little?
Right. That's a tough conversation to have. I have it pretty often, so I think I've fine-tuned it a little bit here.
Yeah, well,
there.
Then I'd love to hear more.
I think at the end of the day, we've adopted the UN Declaration of Human Rights, and in that it says that housing is a human right. So as a nation, I think that, or as a contributor to the UN, I think that it's our duty to follow that Declaration of Human Rights. As difficult as it may be, it is our duty as a nation to do that. After that, we know that housing first and human rights are part of our social work tradition and are the basic needs for us to survive: food, shelter, etc. So, and for us to not provide that to folks puts us in a position of power and hierarchical decisions that put our fellow man and our fellow citizens at risk. And that's just also not a right thing to do. From a fiscal standpoint, though, it's a smart, conservative way to approach a problem.
This is where I think you really start to make inroads with people who might be a little suspicious. You're saying right. This is actually more cost-effective.
Way more cost effective. If you look at the cost of somebody being in jail or in prison, often our homeless will do petty crimes during the winter to go to jail. Three hots in a cot, if you will. And so those costs equal around $40,000 to $60,000 a year in emergency room visits, inpatient stays, hospital, et cetera. And so when we look at that cost and we compare it to housing costs, we see a significant drop. So housing for us, person-centered housing options, our unit budget for an individual household is around $10,000 per year annually. That covers support services, that covers the housing, that covers any of their needs, sometimes a food stipend, etc. And so we see reductions in drug and alcohol use, we see reductions in mental health symptoms, we see reductions in emergency room use. Our agency alone has seen a 27% reduction in emergency room usage, and that equates to a financial number, and we know that. So we're saving money and we're bringing the costs down for housing in general.
Okay.
And who can argue with that?
Alan, do you agree with that standpoint?
I do. They're very powerful numbers, but I'd like to take a step back for just a second on something you asked that I think is really important, and that is what comes to mind when we hear that word homeless. I think for many viewers, many of us, it's normal to operate our day with a prejudice or stereotype. They think of a homeless person as very dirty, begging for money. Why can't they pull themselves up by their bootstraps? Why can't they just go get a job? Why can't they do this or that the way any one of us who have housing would do? But when I'm dealing with clients during the day, you have to imagine that it's almost like camping for months on end. How do you go get ready for a job if you don't have a place to live? You don't have money for a haircut, a shave, clean clothes. How do you do anything and not fall into a trap of depression and anxiety that becomes overwhelming? And I think the combination of the numbers and the humanity of helping people who are really struggling, those two things are the powerful message that I think we want to get across with Housing First. Let's get someone into housing where they can shower, they can get help, they can eat, they can address issues that are plaguing them. That's the whole goal of Housing First.
Well, let me ask our panel one more question, then we're coming to your phone call. So Sharon in Rochester, stay there. And by the way, Sharon, we wanted to know Peter's email address again because interested in the symposium next month. So Peter, one more time. If people want to contact you, want to register for the Housing First Symposium that is Wednesday, September 27th at RIT, they can get in touch with you how?
Peter W. Peters at me.com.
Piece of cake. Peter W. Peters at me.com. Sharon, stay there. We're coming to you in a moment. We'll take some more of your phone calls in a moment. But let me go around the table and follow up with Alan and ask all of our guests this question. Then if what you, and Nick, frankly, what all of our guests are saying about Housing First lines up, that it is not only viewed as a human right, it's being viewed as a human right around the world, the UN and others. It is in our faith tradition. It is certainly in secular values, and it is fiscally a better decision for society to make. Then what are the barriers? What are the main barriers standing in the way of this?
The main barriers, I think, for the person coming off the street is having someone who hears what they need, empathy. Okay, and I think right now we're in an empathy crisis in the United States. And I think we at the table.
Why do you say that? Go ahead.
I think that is a major barrier, and I believe there's not enough information for our community that can provide assistance, that they believe and get behind the model. We're still in the shelter mentality.
Okay. What do you think, Nick? What's the barrier to Housing First really being sort of more embraced by all levels of government, understood throughout society?
I think Housing First is a very creative and innovative approach, but it can be very challenging to reach that place. As programs transition from punitive-based measures or corrective measures with people, it can be really challenging for them to understand the difference between providing housing and enabling behavior. And so from a social work standpoint, that can be a challenge. I think we also, in some areas, have a difficult time moving the political needle forward. And so I think in our community, our local Department of Human Services, our continuum of care, our city government, our county government has started to steer towards this model as an evidence-based practice. And so I think we're on the right track here. And I'm thankful to those government entities for that. but I think those can be challenging barriers. And of course, and I think Connie's going to say this, is affordable housing. Enough housing to house everybody is a challenge here.
Okay.
Affordability is we do sort of a quick and dirty needs sort of analysis with all of the providers through the Homeless Services Network. Affordability was definitely the number one barrier to housing homeless families and individuals, and that certainly extends to low income households in general. Homeless population is low income. They wouldn't be homeless if they weren't low income. And in order to house people in units that are safe and in areas where it is safe for people to live, the rent is just not sufficient provided through public benefits. I think people have image again of people who get public benefits who are taking advantage of the system. A single person on public assistance in this community has a housing allowance of $257 a month. There's absolutely nowhere in this community that anybody can live for $257 a month. And until there is a change in terms of how the public sector is going to spend funds. Is it more important to keep people housed, which will lead to productivity, or are they not going to? And I think that's the final answer. We're able to do supportive housing because with the limited funding that we do have, we're able to provide deep rent subsidies. People who live in those units pay 30% of their household income for rent, or that $257 if they're on public assistance and happen to be a single individual. Without those, it just isn't possible.
Okay. Reverend Peters?
I echo what Alan said. I think that there is a lack of empathy in our culture right now. And also think that it's not the normal experience for people to meet homeless people and learn their stories. And one of the things I've learned in ministry is that until you've learned a person's story, you really don't know that person and you don't know who they are and what they struggle with. I also think that there is a prejudice against homeless people thinking that before they can be homed, put in a house, they need to rehabilitate, they need to change their behavior. And that seems to me to be the wrong way around. People change better when they feel secure. And finally, I would say that one of the things that strikes me as being central to this whole issue of homelessness is our whole way we do our economy. I've written about the need for living wages in this community, and it seems to me that part of what we do is we put people on the borderline of homelessness, because in this country, I believe it's something like 50 million families are on the edge of homelessness because they are paying more than 25% of their income in rent. And so it seems to me that what we've got to address are the economic factors that lead people into homelessness at a macro level, and we're not doing a good job at that. We tend to reward the wealthy and starve the poor, and we need to reverse that.
All right, I need to get our only break of the hour, and we come back, we'll take your phone call. Sharon and Rob, hang there, and we'll also welcome more calls as we go throughout the hour talking about homelessness in our community. It's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You just heard Reverend Peter Peters, who's a retired Episcopal priest and founding member of REACH, the Rochester Emergency Action Committee for the Homeless. Connie Sanderson, executive director of the Rochester Monroe County Homeless Continuum of Care. Nick Coulter is co-founder of Person-Centered Housing Options, and Alan Gordon is a senior case manager for the VOA. Your phone calls are next. Coming up in our second hour, is New York State going to have a constitutional convention? Is this the year? Is it time? What are the issues in play here? What could be impacted? What are the risks and benefits? Constitutional convention doesn't come up very often. Voters don't get the chance very often. We'll make sure you're set with everything you need to know next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Whether you are a candidate running for office, a person in business and comes in for a conversation here, or someone promoting an upcoming symposium, just about no one is ready with a phone number and email. Just because people don't think about self-promotion. That's okay, Reverend Peters. Reverend Peters is giving out his personal email address if you want to attend the Housing First Symposium next month. And that's peterwpeters@me.com to get in touch with him. But if you go to rockhomeless.org, not only will you get a lot of good information, but I'm finding there's some more information on the Housing Symposium, along with a contact there for Josh Sankowski at Pathstone if you want more information there. So if you go to rockhomeless.org, you'll find a contact there. You can use it. If you want to use Reverend Peters, you can use it as well. The symposium is next month. It's Wednesday, September 27th. Out at RIT from 8:30 to 4. I want to take some of your phone calls. And by the way, Reverend Peters, you're in good company, by the way. I didn't say that. That was just an observation. But there's a lot of great ways for people to get in touch if they want to go out and attend the Housing First Symposium, which is next month. Let's take some phone calls. And I'm going to start with Sharon in Rochester. Go ahead, Sharon.
Reverend Peters, can you hear me okay? I'm on speakerphone.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Perfect. You touched my heart with what you're saying about these homeless people, and I am so glad to hear somebody as passionate about it as you are. It's really a multifaceted problem, and I want to give you one example which I think could really help out. My friend has a daughter who's got her master's, and she's married. She's working for minimum wage or a little bit above that. She has two children, and if it wasn't for her mother babysitting, she would have to do something else. Being married, she's not eligible for all the assistance that single parents are. So one of my suggestions is daycare. It's unaffordable. And as I said, many of my friends are babysitting their grandchildren, or their kids could not work. I would propose there should be daycare before and after at schools somehow. And it should be affordable, and for people that really have no money, it should be free. That is number one right there, to keep the single mothers and married mothers working. Number two, as you said, everybody deserves to have a home. This winter's here are a bitter pill to swallow. Now I'm going to come up for air and let you talk.
Okay. Sharon, I hear both those concerns. And the first thing I would say to you about childcare, I'm also a member of Children's Agenda, and you should go to their website. And they have been advocates for affordable childcare for a long, long, long time. And we've had campaigns to try and raise funds from the state government. We've had some success. We've tried to raise funds from the county government. We've had minimal success with the county. But I think that there's a significant factor that leads people into even greater poverty stress. So thank you for those points.
Yeah, and let me ask our other guest to comment too. Nick, go ahead.
Yeah, we thought about that extensively when we built a couple of our programs. And one of the allowable costs from HUD is childcare costs. And so while our families are looking for units or apartments to live in, we provide some childcare payments so that they can look for housing.
Okay. Thoughts on that, Al?
I mean, there's a lot of barriers to getting into any type of housing, especially when you're talking about minimum wage. We're dealing with only men in our shelters right now, but we do provide services like transportation and all sorts of case management assistance so that people aren't trying to stretch too far beyond. Because if you imagine trying to go to work and you're taking the bus every day on minimum wage, you don't have much money. You know, it's very difficult.
One thing that, before I go back to your phone calls, just want to follow up with our guests and just kind of ask generally, whenever we talk about anti-poverty efforts and efforts to help people who are homeless in this community, we talk about how difficult it is just to have basic transportation. Has that gotten any better in this community in the last few years?
I certainly don't think so. I mean, the cost of a car, insurance, and maintenance is well beyond anyone who's on human services.
Of course, but are there better options? Are there public options? Are there transportation options? Are we reconfiguring what we're doing to reach more people?
I think RTS does a fairly good job of getting people if they need to go to one spot. But if we're talking about someone who's working or someone who's doing a job search, speaking specifically of something they need to do to keep their benefits active, you're talking about a five-hour day on a bus to just do their job search. That's excessive. And I don't think that is a really good use of time. I think that if you're talking about from one spot to another, works fine.
Okay. Nick, can we do better?
Oh, yeah, we can certainly do better. I think some of the routes for transit are a bit challenging for some of our more rural homeless individuals. So that's one thing that we can do better. I do like the bikes out on the street. I think a couple of our recipients have been using the temporary bikes. We do have a couple. Our Community Bikes is a great organization that provides bikes for folks that have a referral for free. We're in Rochester, so a bike's only useful for so long. And I think Alan speaks to it well. I don't need to add much more to it. These trips on buses to get to housing or to find housing is all day. And so if you have multiple requirements, you have to give up something.
Is that a political will issue to get that changed? Better lines, more lines. I'm just trying to figure out how are we going to change this.
I think so. I think from my understanding, and you know, I don't understand every nuance of
sure.
government, but from what I understand, I think it is a political will for us to change that and to look at different populations more as a need for that.
Okay. Go ahead, Connie. And I see the phone ringing. We'll get back to your calls in just a second.
So if we're successful even at getting people permanently housed, to move people to a higher level of self-sufficiency, which, you know, hopefully means employment for many people, employment opportunities have steadily migrated outside Rochester. Now, if employment activities were sort of in the center city or just outside, I think public transportation works really well for that group of people. But if you're needing to get to a job in, Victor or Henrietta, you're talking extreme, you know, having to leave for work 2.5 hours before you need to be there. And if you're working a second or third shift, those bus routes probably aren't even existent if you're trying to get home at midnight or get to work at that time.
All right, so I'm starting to feel overwhelmed looking at the clock. We've got so much to get to. But one more quick question, Connie. I feel like we've had that conversation for years now.
Mm-hmm.
Are we ever going to have a conversation where we say, you know what? It is so much better that when we do housing first, and we know that housing is something that not only do we feel is a right, but it's the fiscally responsible thing to do. It's the way to treat fellow human beings like fellow human beings. And they're going to be able to get to work because we're doing this much better. Are we ever going to have that conversation? I feel like we have the same conversation every year on this.
Well, it's hoped, and I think as a continuum, and the organizations in Homeless Services Network, we're really trying to break down some of the silos and systems, and ensure that the housing and homeless system is working with the healthcare system. If it needs to work with the public transportation systems, because the issues cross just cross over and need to be addressed by everybody.
NPR reported in 2015 that the Utah population of chronically homeless people dropped by 91% after a decade of work with Housing First initiatives. And again, that's chronically homeless, not general homeless population. But according to NPR, the idea of Housing First was very appealing to service providers in Utah, that over the work of a decade, that they decided clients do have to pay some rent, either 30% of income or up to $50 a month, whatever is greater. But they had a remarkable drop by 91%. I don't know, Nick, could we point to models like this in a lot of places? Do you feel like the evidence is there in other communities for Housing First to work?
Well, the evidence is everywhere. Every place I go, I've been to LA, I've been down to Texas, I've been down locally. We have great programs in Buffalo and Syracuse and Albany. And it all shows and hovers around 80 to 92% reduction. Nationally, we've seen a reduction of about 43% in chronic homelessness from 2005 to 2012. And I think it just continues to go down because of Housing First.
I know that the featured lead speaker at the Housing Symposium next month is Daniel Malone, who's the executive director of DESC, that's in Seattle, and known as a pioneer in the Housing First model in the PAC Northwest, right?
Yeah.
So you'll be able to hear more if you attend the Housing First Symposium. All right, we're going to try to get through all five phone lines before the hour, but I am going to take one more question online. Don asked a question I think is a really good, it's a good faith question, no pun intended. Don said, thank you to Reverend Peters, but what's the argument for human rights from an atheist perspective? I think it's a fair question, isn't it? I mean, I understand, Reverend, your background, your work background, and I, you know, but for our secular and atheist listeners, what's the Housing First argument there?
Well, I mean, one could learn an awful lot from Karl Marx, and go to the wonderful things that both he and others have talked about, the care of the working classes. The reason we want Housing First is because no one deserves to be outside in the cold. And whether you're a faith person or an atheist, that's true. You're a human being. I speak as a person of faith, and I look at people as human beings from my faith perspective. But I hope you, as an atheist, look at other human beings and consider them as your potential brothers and sisters, and so treat them with that kind of respect. And that kind of human respect is certainly central to the core of Marxism, which, as I understand it, is somewhat atheistic.
And I would just urge Don for maybe a little bit of interesting insight on this. Read Sam Harris's The Moral Landscape, which touches on an atheist perspective on morality that isn't reliant on scripture or other religious texts, but also says that it is inherent in us. And it takes a look at a scientific perspective for that. All right, let's get through a lot of your phone calls here because we have a lot and we're going to try to move quickly. Lori in Rochester. Go ahead, Lori.
Hi, Evan. I was just wondering if there was any coordinated effort with churches. Many of these churches in Rochester have vans available, and if there's any coordinated transportation efforts to get individuals to their prospective appointments en masse.
Lori, thanks for the question. Guests, any thoughts on that?
I don't know of any.
I don't think there's any coordinated effort, and I do know that sometimes we've used churches and other resources like that for supports. Oftentimes, due to liability and policies, it can be very challenging for a church to take on that kind of responsibility, and that's where we run into roadblocks.
We have had volunteers individually from different faith communities come and take guests to medical appointments or other kinds of social appointments that they need to make.
All right, let me go back to the phone to John in Rochester next. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hey, a couple questions. I've noticed some of the new low-income housing projects, moderate-income housing projects, have cost anywhere from $200,000 a unit to well into $300,000 per unit. Is there a way that could be toned down to spread the wealth a little bit to other types of housing instead of building these higher quality units? The other comment I wanted to make is I was kind of disappointed in the Reverend talking about Karl Marx. Some of Karl Marx's followers included Joseph Stalin and Mao Zedong. Karl Marx has led to a lot of the chaos in the world right now, in the economic, people being deprived of economic benefits and economic vitality.
All right, John, thanks for the phone call. Reverend, you want to recant any of that on Karl Marx?
Well, I think that even Karl Marx would not have always endorsed Stalin and his policies, and that he had a humanist side to him that is quite credible. So I don't want to go any further with that. What I would like to challenge is this idea that public housing costs between $200,000 and $300,000 a unit. I find that to be an egregious figure. But what's more important is the federal government did at one point set a limit on the amount of money that could be spent on units. And what that led to was actually some very poorly built public housing units. So I think it's a question worth investigating, but I would challenge the $200,000 to $300,000.
Okay.
I actually would have to say that that cost is probably fairly accurate.
Wow.
But I guess you have to just consider what you just said. The older affordable housing stock was very poorly built. It has to be totally done over. The new affordable units that are built have very high energy cost savings in them. They're definitely built to last for a minimum of 25 years. And if you build, it's like anything, you get what you pay for. And if you build cheap, it just isn't going to last.
Okay. And Nick, just real briefly before we jump back to the phones, John's thinking, let's spend a little less and maybe do a little bit more of this. When we talk about housing first here, do you have good options right now for people who have needs?
We do. We have, we just got a new program through Person-Centered Housing Options. We have about 70 to 80 housing units for individuals and families. We are bringing that online right now. We have staff finding folks and putting them in housing and providing support services to them. There's different ways to fund these kinds of things. So we can reduce costs in other areas, but developing housing quality, very high quality housing that lasts, like what Connie said, 25 plus years, requires a little bit more money. So we're gonna save money in some areas, and I think we can redistribute it in others.
Let me tell you a story, Evan. Though 2 weeks ago, I was with Andy Carey with MC Collaborative, which is another organization that is housing people. And this lady, Kathy, who's got some emotional challenges. I witnessed Andy put her into public rental property that she had enough money to do to afford it. What she didn't do very well is managing her money. She was not a good money manager. So Andy has set up a system through her bank where she makes direct payments, and she's in affordable housing with her own money. So not all homeless people are desperate with money. Many of them are. But in this instance, here was a lady who, because of Andy Carey and that organization, along with what Nick is doing, was able to be put into a home.
All right, let me get Rob, who has been waiting to join the conversation. And Rob is on one. Go ahead, Rob.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Really quick, I just wanted to say something about the Karl Marx thing. You cannot compare Stalin with Marx. Stalin practiced communism, not Marxism. Communism is bastardized Marxism.
Good for you.
Now, I've been homeless off and on for about 20 years, and I've spent the last 3, maybe 4 winters outside, one of which was the coldest we've had on record, and one of which was we've had the most snow on record. I've been battling for 6 months. I've been living in a tent for 6 months after being thrown out of a halfway house for appearing to be under the influence. Gave them multiple negative blood screens, urine screens, and they still threw me out. The empathy with these people is non-existent. A lot of it has to do with mental health issues, and the money that is being spent on mental health in Rochester is the money is dwindling. What they call it is consolidation. What they're doing is closing places, and they're saying they're consolidate, and it leaves people like me screwed. You know, I have a case manager. I go to outpatient. I'm involved with all these places, and they can't get me into a house, into an apartment.
ESS
in Rochester is a joke as well.
Rob, let's just wait for a second. And first of all, I just want to express my gratitude for you willing to share your story. And I know it's not easy. I certainly can't. Personally relate, and I'm trying to learn from it. Nick, I know some of the things he said there, he's got some tough things to say about opportunity, options, what's going on. What's your first reaction when you hear this, Nick?
I just want you to call us, Rob. That's basically it, and I think the VOA would echo that
yes, as well.
I think where the VOA may not have a unit right now, I don't know what Alan's status is, but we do have units. It sounds like your story would apply to our eligibility requirements. And so our phone number, Rob, is 585-736-HOME. That's a four.
Hold on 1 second. Let me grab a pen.
Hey, Rob, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to put you on hold so you can make sure you keep listening and listen to what both of these phone numbers, I think Alan and Nick, will give you. So go ahead, Nick.
Yeah, so our PCHO's phone number is 585-736-4663 or 736-HOME. We'll have an intake specialist go over all of your criteria, and we'll start looking for housing. As long as we know you're eligible, we'll look for housing that day. And that's about it for the process. You don't need to do much more.
One more time, the phone number. He's trying to write it down.
736-HOME.
Okay. Alan?
I would say that we do have some openings. And Rob, this is, Rob's story is not uncommon to be heard. So I want to give my phone number first. And you can call me directly at 465-2297, 465-2297. And one of the things that we operate under is the idea of our services in the community that also will help but can create some homelessness. You have someone who's an addict being admitted to a program because of their addiction and getting kicked out because of their addiction. That is a major deal. And one of the things that I bring to the table is that we were one of the punitive programs a couple of years ago that Nick brought up, that we had certain rules you had to apply by. And we have changed over to Housing First and found it to be much more successful and much more calm than it was before. We're less on rules and we're more on let's get the housing first. How is Rob supposed to deal with his addiction on the street? He can't. That's ridiculous. He should be someplace where he's calm and he's got a space to be, he's safe, and then we can work on the addiction.
All right, Rob, first of all, much love to you and good luck to you. I hope that this has opened up a new door for you, and thank you for sharing your experiences. Alan said it's not uncommon, but sometimes it's just knowing what services are out there and the work that's going on in our community, whether it's VOA, whether it's Nick Coulter, who is the co-founder of Person-Centered Housing Options. And as we get ready to lose the hour here, I mean, we could have, in the last 5 minutes, the phone has just not stopped ringing. There's so many experiences that people want to share, perspectives, and what I would say is you've got a great chance to continue that conversation at the Housing First Symposium. That's Wednesday, September 27th, if you want to mark your calendar. Wednesday, September 27th, out at RIT. It's from 8:30 to 4, and a lot of different ideas are going to be presented. You got a chance to jump on rochomeless.org if you want contact information, or you can email the Reverend. It's peterwpeters@me.com. PeterWPeters@me.com. 20 seconds, Reverend. What do you hope that comes out of Wednesday, September 27th in the symposium this year?
My hope is that we have a conversation that excites and empowers the local community to have a more systemic approach to the question of homelessness.
Okay. And Nick, if we're successful, are we going to see models like we see? I mean, NPR reporting on Utah. Eventually, is there going to be stories about how Rochester and Western New York's Housing First is going to bring down that chronically homeless population?
I think with the excellent talent here, we're going to have a great great community of Housing First providers.
Well, this is a conversation that needs to continually be had, and I've got to do a better job of making sure we're on top of it, because look at the remarkable people working in this community. Thank you for all the calls. Got through as many as we could. Reverend, thank you for calling it to our attention. We'll see you next month at the symposium. Thank you so much, Connie. Nice seeing you here. Nick, really appreciate it. And so much, thanks so much to Alan and the team from VOA as well. So much to talk about with this. We'll have to continue to have have the conversation on homelessness in the future. More Connections coming up.